Welcome to the DJE Podcast, where you will learn about real estate investing from real life examples. Here's your host, Devin Elder.
Okay, today on the show, we have Mr. Jeff Greenberg with us. Jeff is the CEO of Synergetic Investment Group. He's been acquiring both multifamily and student housing since 2008. And his current focus is working with investors and bringing them together with high quality deal sponsors. Really excited to dive in. Without further ado, Jeff, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Devin.
Yeah, great to have you on. So you've been in the multifamily and student housing world since 2008. I've got some specific questions around that, but first I want to learn a little bit about your background for our listeners, and how did you come to real estate initially?
Well, back in 2005, 2006, messing around with the single family world, it was not a real good time to be trying to buy REOs, which we were looking at. About 2007, started learning about multifamily. And so getting myself educated in multifamily at that time, which was a pretty good time to be looking at it, except that I didn't realize what great opportunities were out there. And hindsight, I would have grabbed up a lot more in that period. But everything was under stress, and there was some opportunities out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Hindsight's a tough one. I mean, we should have grabbed Bitcoin when it was a penny. That would have worked out well too. So it's hard. We can't play the hindsight game. What brought you to real estate? Was it a mentor group or a book or a friend or relative? What sparked that initial interest?
Well, initially, I was just on a walk with a friend, and I happened to be going through a divorce. And he mentioned that he was going to go into real estate. And at that time, my knowledge of real estate was, okay, you go buy a single family house and you rent it out. And that was real estate. And from there, I started to get myself educated. We were looking at short sales. We were looking at REOs. And it wasn't until I met somebody that was doing multifamily. It was a guru that was talking about getting in multifamily with a little of your own money, but using the leverage of other investors. And that kind of piqued my interest. And so that was when I started looking at multifamily properties. That was about in 2007.
Got it. And so you're 2007, and then the mortgage crisis is kind of right around the bend. How did that impact your outlook on multifamily versus single family at the time, kind of this 2008, debacle that we all saw?
Yeah, well, what I was seeing was opportunities. There were properties that were stressed out. We weren't looking in my local market, which is California, because California was taking a pretty good hit. But we were looking in Texas and a few other markets that weren't being hit as bad. But every time we would go talk to a broker and they found out that we were from California, they said, well, typically we were finding, oh, these are California owners here. And they don't know how to operate the property and they let it go to pot. So it was a good opportunity to find properties. We were looking for 8.5 caps back then, not realizing, what great opportunities there were.
Yeah. There's been a lot of cap rate compression since then, no doubt. So how did you go about building, you mentioned syndication. That was attractive to raise capital for deals and go into bigger deals. How did you go about with that first kind of syndication deal, getting investors on board? And what was that syndicated amount you're shooting for in that first larger multifamily deal?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first deal we did was actually 5 fourplexes. It was $1 million purchase, which was, crazy amount of money for us at the time. Right. And we were, our raise was going to be about $350,000. And my partner, I had a partner at the time, and she went to her business associates, her past employers, her friends, and she got about half of it. And the rest of it I got essentially from people I had met either through Bigger Pockets. I was pretty active back then on Bigger Pockets, or people I had met at different real estate events. And none of it was from my friends and family. It was, mm-hmm. you know, all people that I had met since I got into the business and started expanding my network. But together we raised that $350,000, which was a huge project at that time.
Yeah, right. I think crossing over into just taking other people's money, period, is a huge kind of step, even if it's $50,000, right? On, you know, when you're starting out, that's a big task. Obviously, you know, we've heard it from a lot of people. You probably feel the same, that you feel a much higher standard towards other people's capital than even your own capital. And so even $350,000 is probably a big weight on your shoulders for that deal. Is that how that felt going into it?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the advantage we had on this, this was a 2005 build, and we were, excuse me, I'm sorry. That was a 2007 build that we had bought in 2010. So we had a three-year-old property. We had 100% wow. occupancy. And we thought, okay, this is a home run. You know, what can go wrong? And the thing is we really didn't know much about value adds at the time. And the big value add, the only value we had, was really raising rents. They were already mm-hmm. paying their own electric. We did try to do some rubs on the water and raise rents. And that was our bigger problem, was adding value to the property. But we felt pretty comfortable bringing in people's money because here we had this new property, 100% occupied. You know, what could go wrong? The biggest problem was to add enough value by the end of the deal to be able to recoup or to get some equity, to get some value at the end. So that was the lesson there. So the comfort level wasn't difficult because it was, you know, such a new property and in a great location. All of that was good. It was just increasing the value was the biggest issue.
And this was a standard market rate property?
Yeah, it was a property that it was the developers owned it at the time. They had developed in 2007 and they got stuck with them because they couldn't mm-hmm. sell it at that point.
Sure.
Yeah. And so we were buying it from the developers, and the lender, which was a little tiny little commercial bank in McAllen, Texas, and they wanted these guys out. They may have been good developers, but they were lousy property managers, and the bank wanted them out. They there was two different developers on this property, and they were both, you know, 3 years behind on their taxes. And so
the bank let it go that far, huh?
It's a two branch bank.
Yeah.
You know, they could have gone to a foreclosure, but when they met us and, we, you know, talked about what we were doing and how we were learning and educating ourselves, they were thrilled. They were thrilled to get us in, because we wanted to be there and the current owners didn't want to be there. So the bank bent over backwards to try to get us into the deal. And so that was a great experience right there, is working with a very small bank.
Yeah, that's great. So they were able to stay in the deal. They just liked you guys as a new operator.
Yeah. I mean, officially we assumed the loan. I mean, actually it was five different fourplexes. So it was actually five different loans, five different properties. Officially they put it down as an assumption, but it really wasn't, because the interest rate that we had was much lower than what was original on the development loan. And the loan amount, the bank actually went out and went to one of the developers and asked them to carry a second for us, because we didn't want to come in with any more money. I mean, they wrote it all up. They wrote up the contract. They gave it to the developer and said, here, sign this, because we told them, they said, look, we can't come in with any more money. This is what we got. And so they did that for us. And, you know, the one of the developers was able to carry a note.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. There's a lot of creativity sometimes on the financing here to get these things done. Is that a property you guys still own, or have you gone full cycle on that?
We've gone full cycle. We bought it in 2010. We sold it in 2016. Mm-hmm. We started selling it in 2015 at about 4.5 years. But as I was saying, that we didn't add enough value to it. So the closing costs were going to kill our profits. And so we kind of drew a line in the sand and said, okay, we're hanging on to this until we get this price. And the bank actually gave us a year extension. And we held on until we got a buyer that gave us our price. So our investors came out with a fair return, not what we had hoped for. And, but you know, they got a decent return. It was a lot better than they were doing in the banks. You know, so it was a good lesson. We got a good education out of that property.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you get as much education as you can, books, seminars, networking, et cetera. And then there's really that other half of the education is going out and doing it. And that's a whole new world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You learn so much more when you're doing it.
Yep. It all kind of gels when you're actually out there doing it. So what happened after, you know, you're into this first project? Did you get the bug and decide, hey, we want to do more of this, we want to start actively looking for the next acquisition? Or was it kind of maintenance mode for a while in that first project?
No, actually, we were anxious prior to getting this one, as well as once we got it, to keep on going. We were extremely conservative. And so there was a lot of deals that I'm looking back at now that we certainly should have gotten into that we ended up passing on. But we finally did get to a deal in Houston that was a much better deal for everybody around, for us as well as our investors.
And what kind of an asset was that? Is this a big property, clean, or was it a heavy lift?
That one was a 62-unit property. That one, the guy we were buying it from actually bought it out of foreclosure. He had been working on it for 2 years. So he had it up to about 85% occupied. I think he said he went down, he had it a bought it at 60% occupied, and it dropped down to like 40, and he eventually got it up to 85, and I think he paid like $650,000 for it, and we paid $1.3 million. But I don't think he made much money, considering that he probably put, you know, that much money into it.
Sure.
We got it at 85% occupied, and so then the plan was to hold it for 5 years, you know, get it up to 95, and to sell it for a good profit, maybe 2.1 to 2.3. And it ended up in 3 years, we got it up to 95% occupied. The cap rate was compressing, and we were able to sell it for 2.7 in 3 years. So that was a super opportunity.
You would kind of walk it back, Jeff, and talk about what a cap rate compressing means for somebody that's maybe newer to multifamily investing, what impact does that have on your sale price, and how does that work?
Well, by the cap rates going down, absolutely, it affects your valuation of the property. So as the cap rate compresses down, your increase in value moves up by multiples. A couple things that happened as well as the cap rate was, I believe we were at a revenues of maybe $36,000 a month, and with the increased occupancy and the increased occupancy, and then we're also we're changing over to RUBS, which for those that don't know, that's where we bill back on the utilities. We brought that up to about $42,000 a month, and with that and the compression of the cap rate, it increased that value a great deal. But you know, on a seven cap deal, increasing your revenue by $100, say $100 a month, can add, you know, depends on, you know, what it was, but it can add $10,000, it can add $100,000 worth of value on your right. property, depending on how many units you have and how many you're able to do that with.
Yeah, it is really an amazing thing to be able to create a little bit more net operating income and see sometimes a 15 or 20x multiple in value off that. It's pretty amazing.
Absolutely. That's the one of the parts of commercial real estate I love, that you're not stuck with the comps. You're not stuck right. with what's going on typically with your single family neighborhood. That this is a business. It's a business, and it's valued as a business. It just happens to be on real estate, and you can push the value of the property. By either increasing your revenues or decreasing your expenses. And that's the challenge part. That's the fun part, is seeing what you can do with the numbers and increase the value of the property.
Yeah, it can be really powerful, really powerful. So what are you working on right now in your portfolio? Some big repositions, just managing some stabilized deals. What does a kind of a day in the life look like with your existing portfolio?
Well, right now we've got a fairly large property that we are repositioning up in Amarillo, Texas. That's a 225 unit. And mm-hmm. that one, we're pushing the occupancy, we're pushing the rents, we're building community, mm-hmm. taking care of a lot of deferred maintenance. That one's a big project, but I got a great team working on that. So we're doing that one. I have a student housing property. We were talking about that earlier, mm-hmm. I think before we started the show here, that that property was in a small market, but it was, it's 36 units. It was 48% occupied, 30% economic. And for those that you don't know the terms, that means that only 30% of the people were paying, and the other number of people were living there without having to pay. And that one we got out of foreclosure. We actually bought it from a note holder and took it over. So we bought it for $1.1 million. And right now we've just got it under contract last week for $3.5 million. So we're excited about that one. That's a huge value add, sure. Mainly getting it occupied with paying tenants, as well as fixing it up. I mean, we did put a lot of money into it. It was a 1999 build, so the building itself wasn't bad. All the interiors were a mess. So we redid almost every floor in the entire property, the hallways, all the units. And so we put about $500,000 into it. But now with the 2.5 sale price, that's going to give us a nice return.
Yep. That's powerful. And it's a really simple business plan, right? I mean, it's not easy work by any means, but you're fixing stuff up, curing deferred maintenance, making it a nice place to live. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the target. And amazingly, there's a lot of operators that let it slip out of that state, right?
Absolutely. And back to the Amarillo one, the team is created such an awesome community there that we were at 85% occupied when we took it over, and that dropped down to 60%, which we kind of expected. Sure. Well, we expected it to drop. We didn't expect it to go down that far. But now we're about 8 months into it, and we're almost back up to 80%. But what's exciting about that particular project is we had some tenants that left they left just when we were taking it over, and they came back. They came back, and now they're renters from us again because of the changeover in the community. So sure. Just seeing things like that, okay, yes, they're accepting what we're doing. They like what we're doing. The atmosphere has totally changed, and we're getting people back in. And so we're real excited about how that's going.
Yeah, that's great. Congratulations on that. How are you guys in multiple geographies here? How are you guys handling property management? Is it in-house, third-party, multiple third-party companies? How do you like to approach that?
That's all multiple third parties. It's essentially, who is working in that market. And the management company that we actually have in Amarillo is actually out of Houston. Like I said, they're doing an awesome job. My student housing properties, each one is a different company because we're so far apart. But these are companies that pretty much specialize in student housing. So that's that's a totally different it's a whole different issue is with the student housing. And you have to be with somebody that really specializes in student housing. Most property management companies are not set up to handle the special nuances of student housing.
Yeah, I got to imagine that's a completely different animal. We don't play in that space at all, but the seasonality, the number of tenants, the maybe parties or whatever happens, but then you've got maybe stronger co-signers. I mean, a whole new set of variables, right?
Absolutely. And you have, the personalities. I mean, sometimes we'll do roommate matching. I mean, what property management is going to be able to handle roommate matching? We just had a big taco truck over on the university campus on our Tucson property where people, there was another event. And people would come over to our taco truck and have the opportunity to meet our property manager and to hand out, information about the property. We have people that are on, Facebook and Twitter and all these other programs where they're promoting the property. And typically your normal management company really doesn't get into that much, but it's essential on student housing.
Right. Yeah, that's good insights there. What have you guys found? I guess moving forward, you are still in the syndication space, still raising capital, but you're also kind of working with different sponsors. Is that right? And what's driving that kind of trajectory for you?
Yeah, I've been doing the syndications for about 10 years now. And on each one of my syndications, I've been essentially the major fundraiser on those deals. And with the amount of work right now to find good deals, I've kind of pulled back a little bit on that. I've had the advantage of associating with some phenomenal deal sponsors, partly with the organization that you and I are in, Devin. Sure. As well as other people that I meet that are quality deal sponsors with great track records. And so one of the things I'm doing now is putting myself out to these other deal sponsors, to see if they need help with raising equity. And I'm putting more effort into that, as well as networking with additional investors, potential investors. So I'm spending a lot more time doing that. And on the other side, as I also do some mentoring, so if people do bring deals to me, I may work with some of my students to help them put a deal together. But for the most part, I'm not putting as much time into finding the deals as I have in the past. I'm letting everybody else find the deals, and hopefully I'll be able to get involved with them.
Yeah, the acquisition side is really labor intensive. I mean, it's turning over a lot of rocks. It's touring a ton of deals, underwriting a lot of deals. I mean, as you know, and we're, you know, talking in early 2020 right now, cap rates are low, prices are high. You know, it does make deals a few years ago look a lot better in some respects. It makes you wish you would have bought more in the past. You know, how much lower can cap rates go? We don't know, but it's definitely labor intensive on the acquisition side. Absolutely. But you can continue to leverage your network and your skill set to get into deal flow and to help investors and so forth, right?
Absolutely. And the thing is I think I have an advantage over a lot of those people that are trying to help raise equity in sure. that I have done all aspects of a syndication. I've gone through all of them, you know, multiple times. And so I could come in and raise the funds and then come in on, you know, and help out with certain aspects, you know, if it's investor relations or going out and helping on due diligence trips or whatever it is, that I do have that advantage that I can bring. But the main thing is I could come in with a more critical eye as far as evaluating the deal sponsor and the deal itself. And that's what I'm doing now is spending time talking to deal sponsors, evaluating their portfolio, their performances, picking a few that could use my help. And then when the deal comes around, I can use my critical eye on evaluating the deal and underwriting it, you know, on top of their underwriting and seeing if I feel that I'm comfortable with their projections and be able to protect my investors as we go forward.
Yeah, I think that's a huge value add that you bring. I mean, it is so much work buying and renovating and getting a property, especially a value add where you're taking it down to 50% or lower. I mean, that is real work. And there's no substitute for having done that. And it just kind of gives you this this eye for things that really you can't get in any other way than actually having gone through it. So when a deal hits your desk and you take a look at it, it's a completely different thing than somebody that's got kind of an academic view of, you know, what you can make a spreadsheet do, right? Which is anything. And so I think that's a huge value add, and that's, you know, that's a huge benefit you bring to the table.
Absolutely. And your point is well taken, is anybody can make a spreadsheet look good.
Yep.
You know, numbers are, you know, you can manipulate them, you know, all you want. And what I tell both my students and anybody else is the most critical piece is the sponsor. The most critical right. piece is the reputation of the sponsor. What has the sponsor done? You know, don't even look at the deal until you really feel good about the deal sponsor. Because a good deal sponsor, one that you can trust, that's got a good reputation, they're gonna be doing the best job they can on those numbers. Somebody else that may be new, and maybe the deal isn't as strong as they would like it to be, can squeeze those numbers in ways that would be very deceiving. Even though they may not be trying to, they just may not be as conservative right. as somebody else. And the thing is you need to trust the person that made those numbers. And that's where I think where the good deal sponsors come in, is their reputation's on the line. They're doing the best they can to do appropriate numbers. And that's why the deal sponsor is so important, that you can trust that they're doing a conservative job putting those numbers in and evaluating the actual deal. They're not under a whole lot of pressure to get a deal done because, you know, they happen to be fairly new and have to get this deal done. So your seasoned sponsors are critical.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, a good sponsor's most valuable asset is their reputation. And so they're not going to risk that for, you know, a deal that they have to get done this quarter or whatever the case is. I mean, if they've got a reputation, it's a lot of work putting that reputation together, and they're not going to put it at risk over one deal that they want to push numbers on just to get a deal done. That's a fantastic point.
As well as my investors that I bring to the table are going into a deal because they trust me. So yeah, it's even more important that I make sure that the deal sponsors, you know, I do the best job I can to vet a deal sponsor, because most, you know, 99% of the time your equity investors don't have the knowledge, don't have the time, don't have the, you know, the expertise to be able to do that. So if I'm going to be doing that for them and bringing them to deals, I have to make sure that I do a good job of only picking a few sponsors that I'm willing to work with.
Yep. Yep, that makes a lot of sense, and your reputation's on the line too. So a lot of careful thought goes into that. Jeff, this has been really good. I appreciate the overview of kind of your career in the multifamily and student housing world. If somebody is listening to this, they want to reach out to you, get to know you a little bit better, what's a good avenue for them to do that?
Well, they can go to my website. That's synergeticig.com. That's synergeticig.com. Or they can email me at jeff@synergeticig.com. The same spelling. I respond to people from Bigger Pockets as well. So either of those avenues will work.
Great. Well, we'll link to the website in the show notes as well, so people have that. But Jeff Greenberg, thanks so much for jumping on today. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you sharing your story and your insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, Devin. It was a pleasure, and I hope you have a great day.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the DJE Podcast. For more information, please go to djetexas.com.